little background to where we are right now, and it's always important to remember it contextually. Because you get a whole picture of the Torah differently if you see it contextually. So basically, going back to the book of Exodus, the Jewish people went out of Egypt, and the purpose of going out of Egypt was to get into freedom and also to be able to serve God in a manner that is prescribed that will bring you to a level of sanctity, your life to a level of sanctity. Then the second half of the book of Exodus deals with the building of a mishkan. And the mishkan is the public sanctuary where everyone is, public life of Kedusha. And the first part of the book of Leviticus not only deals with sacrifices, but finally the dedication of the mishkan on the eighth day. And we talked last week what happened when Nadav and Abihu brought their sacrifice and what was really demanded of them. Subsequently now, we deal with two things. The two primal tribes of every human being are, what are the two basic tribes of every human being? Tribes. Food and sex. How come no one knew that? Right. You didn't want to say it. Carol, thank you for your courage. Wow. And thank you for those strawberries. What? Yeah, but... So therefore... at the end of Parshat Shmini, which we did last week, are all the laws about dietary laws to bring you to an elevation of sanctity. And therefore, all the laws of kashrus deal with sanctity. That's the main focus of the laws, the dietary laws, such as, let me give you an example. I told it in another class, is that there's a basic paradox to life, and the paradox to life is, unfortunately, I have to kill another living thing in order to survive, and therefore, if I'm aware of the laws of kashrus, it helps me a little bit to elevate that tendency of destructiveness in order to maintain my own life. The second aspect has to do with the human being as a sexual human being. And there is a fantastic sentence in this parsha on page 476 that I would like to spend a lot of time on. It's only one sentence, but I think it relates to a lot of life, how it's lived in the 20th century, and how it was meant to live based on what the Bible really encouraged. So again, we're on the level of Kedusha. That's the whole purpose of taking the people out of Egypt. And remember, there's a public place for Kedusha, which is called the sanctuary. What do I mean by a public place? Nowadays, it would be the synagogue, committees, federation, going to work. All that is public. However, there's another part of Kedusha, which is called private Kedusha. There's public Kedusha and private Kedusha. And what this class will deal with right now is private Kedusha and how the Torah emphasized what is private Kedusha. Open up to page 476 and read sentence 16, 17, and 18. And I must tell you something before you read it. We have an English translation here, and this English translation is an English translation. Sometimes it's accurate, sometimes it's not accurate. It's known as the Sonsino Press. It was edited by Rabbi Hertz, the late chief rabbi of the British Empire. And there's certain words in Hebrew which have been translated over the years that are completely inaccurate. One of those words is the word tameh. It is usually translated as unclean, and no one knows how to translate that word. So I'm not going to translate it. I'm going to use the word tame. I'm going to tell you that it does not mean unclean, and we will see what it actually does mean. Sentence number 16, page 476. Don, do you want to read that sentence? So this talks about a sexual male and a man who has a nocturnal emission. He should eventually, the next day, go into a mikveh, and he shall be tamei until the evening. And during that time that he is tamei until the evening, now turn to the next page on sentence 31. Continue, Don. Loud, please, loud. While a person is in this state, they're not allowed to go into my mishkan, because the mishkan is a public sanctuary, and this person has had this experience, and there is public kedusha in the sanctuary, such as you bring a sacrifice, or there's public kedusha of a service of Yom Kippur, or public kedusha of doing any of the sacrifices that have previously been mentioned. But during the time of public kedusha, you should not mix that with what's going on within you, particularly if you have had some major human sexual experience. Now let's read back to that sentence 16. I'll read it in Hebrew. Ve'ish ki teitzei mimenu shichvat zera. If a man emits, has a nocturnal emission, v'rachat b'mayim et kol b'saro, v'tamei at ha'aref. So once again, we don't translate the word tamei as unclean. Let's translate it as that he shall be in a state where he shall not be involved in the public demonstration of kedusha. He shall not be involved in a public demonstration of kedusha, but he should more be involved in a private aspect within himself of kedusha. Skip to sentence 18, Mark Gampton, sentence 18 on that page. So if a husband and wife have intimate relations, and during the intimate relations there is sexual intercourse and the semen and sperm enter the woman, in that case both of them have to go into the mikveh the next day, and they shall be tamei, which is translated that they shall not take any public form of kedusha until the evening. Those are the two sentences. Yes, Tom. Married couple. In the time that the Torah was written, they were unaware of the mores of 20th century life in America. But you ask a good question. You know, there's a magazine, I forgot the name of it, where they send in certain statements. And one of the statements is, like, what bracha do you say when you eat pork? Obviously. But people do ask those questions. So, Carol, those were one of those questions. And there are many people who do something, you know, which the Torah does not prescribe, but want to do it with a bracha. Halachically. That's true. This one is arranged marriage. So your question is good, but in this case it refers to a husband and wife, as was understood. Okay. Obviously. Well, one of the things that I'm telling you, the word tamei does not mean unclean. The word tamei, I am translating it as you do not take a public form of sanctity, of kedusha, in the mishkan or in the mikveh. Therefore, what is the Torah saying by this? And how does it indicate that frequently what we do in 20th century American life is totally in dissonance with what the Torah understood married life to be? And then once we understand that, we will frequently hear what people say the morning after the night before was never meant to be based on the Torah. Yes. I understand your question correctly, yes. If I understood, but I want to follow my thing. Yes. Well, it's very interesting. For those who know the Mishnayos, there is one day in the year that it was so important for the high priest not to go to sleep, possibly he would have a nocturnal emission. What day of the year? Yom Kippur. Because if the high priest would have that, he couldn't do the service. So there were special people that were to engage him the entire night in Torah reading and scripture and learning so the high priest would not fall asleep. He would be tired the next day, but he wouldn't fall asleep. Let me go back to what the Torah is talking about. So what am I trying to build up? That the concept of tamei means not public activities of kedusha, of sanctity. So what does it mean? It means, let's take sentence 18, that when a man and woman are together, and they cannot act out publicly the next day until they go to the mikveh and then wait for evening, what should they be doing together the next day? Being together. Exactly. They should be together. In other words, what the Torah is saying, that the sexual experience is such an awe-inspiring experience for both individuals. What is known in different words, in different philosophies, Atman and Amour in French. In French, love means Amour. What does Amour mean? What does it mean? No, what does it mean? Come on, people. Without death. Without death. Amour means A, without, more means death. So the sexual experience that both individuals have is Amour. It means for that particular time that you are together, you can experience a life without death. There is such ecstasy and such mechanisms in the mind, brain, body, and soul that you are without death. And the other word which I mentioned was Atman, which is in which theology? Hindu, right? Who said that? Yes, Hindu theology. And what does Atman mean? You are in total unity with the world at large. So for that moment that you are either in total unity with the world at large, or you have the feeling of Amor being without death, those are such monumental experiences that the next day it would be inconceivable. One second. And which you both have experienced together, you needed each other to experience that. You cannot experience that by yourself. The next day, it would be inconceivable, according to the Torah, that you have an 8 o'clock appointment in the morning with any doctor. It would be, one second, would be inconceivable. And most of the things that many people have told me over the years, that they have always sensed a feeling of tremendous violation, sometimes the man and sometimes the woman, is the next morning, where is that person? And there's a total sense of that intimacy. Perhaps it was lustful, but wasn't it also soulful? And what happened to that the next morning? So basically, one of the things that a religious person has to be aware of, that there is something called private kedusha, private forms of sanctity within yourself and within yourself and the person that you are with. And what we lose sometimes in 20th century America or 20th century life, where so many things happen which are rigid and structured and formed, that we cannot really experience it. Now, how do I know that this is the experience of sexuality? Let's turn back to the first time sexuality is mentioned in the Torah, and turn to page 13. Page 13. Read sentence number one there, Irv Feldman. Okay, stop there. So the word for sexual intimacy in the Bible is v'ha'adam yada et chava ishto, that Adam knew his wife. In other words, sexual relationship is under the euphrate of more and more getting to know one another. And the ability to get to know one another is a lingering process that takes years and years and years and years, and can never happen at a moment, but it must happen before, during, and after special moments of intimacy. So therefore, the Bible has always felt that a sexual intimate relationship is always a process of more and more revealing oneself to oneself and to one another. And therefore, the next day, you're not supposed to be in a public place. You're supposed to have privacy with yourself, with God, and with the other person. First Hindi and then you. Yes.
Thank you.
The answer to that, Kohanim were always working in the temple. So how could they function and work in the temple at the same time? Does anyone know the answer to that? Come on, people here. You've studied with me for so many years. No? No, there were hot, solid mishmarot. What were you saying? They were rotating. Who said that? Yes, Lillian. They were rotating. And there were different mishmarot, different groups of people, groups of Kohanim, and they had rotating service in the temple. And during the time that you were assigned to the Beit HaMikdash, that was your assignment for that particular day. Right. Yes, next. Andy? Very good point. Excellent point, Hindi. I didn't think of that. What Hindi is saying, in pagan idolatry, when they did public worship, they frequently had sexual practices in a public place. And what the Torah is saying is that sexuality is kodesh, but it's done privately. In the public place, we do other forms of kedusha. But in Judaism, this is equally as sanctified, but it's done privately. That's a very good point. I didn't think of that. Yes, first year. I will answer that for you. Tell me why you're asking that. I'm sure he was smarter, or she. Right. Excellent question. Excellent question. But let me explain to you, it's an excellent question because it deserves a good answer. My explanation that I'm sharing with you and with the class right now is the explanation that appeals to me right now in this particular year in April in 1994. Do not hold on to anything I say as the ultimate. Next year, I promise you, I would give a different interpretation. And the year before, I will have given a different interpretation. And one of the things that the Torah says, they're ayin panim la Torah. There are 70 faces to the Torah. And one of the reasons they say 70 is because at that time, each person had 70 years. So each year of your life, you see the Torah differently. One thing I can tell you, if you ever see the Torah the same way in two consecutive years, you have not grown, or you have not changed, or the circumstances of life have not really entered you. Mm-hmm. So nothing I say is gospel, okay? But I can tell you it's true for me right now. So you get my honesty right now. This interpretation that I'm giving is so novel that it surprises me. I am surprised by my own novelty. Yeah. But I must tell you, to be honest with you as well, even though this is my own, before I prepare for the class, I try to cover as many commentaries at home that time permits. So in this particular section, there's a certain book I have at home, which is Torah Shlema, which is a compilation of all the commentaries, and none of them say this. But yet it's compelling to me. Yes, Donna. Right. It could and it could not. Today's the... I have a calendar at home. So I'm not even going to tell you what day it is today. Yes, that's just fine. One second. Does mean is that you shouldn't enter the temple or eat certain sacrificial kadashim, certain animals that you sacrifice. So therefore, my understanding, when it says b'tamei ata erev, that you should be in the category of tamei, I believe this means a private aspect of kedusha, in contrast to the public aspect of holiness, which is done in the mishkan. Therefore, what it really is telling us that there are two parts to you that need to be done very, very carefully. Public kedusha and private kedusha. And those are two parts to you. And in therapy, the thing that is talked about only is aspects of privacy. There was an interesting statement in the book recently that there are a few rooms in a person's home that are totally private. That's usually the bathroom and the bedroom. And those two rooms have their counterparts in your soul as well. Those two rooms. And those are the private parts of kedusha that everyone struggles with. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, Shabbat is a form where the Kedusha comes into you more readily. The Kedusha is always available. On Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, it's always available. Kedusha is to be found if you just see it, if you have the eyes and dimensions to be able to grasp it. Sometimes people need an extra form, so they have the energy of light of Neirot Shabbat. They have the sense that in the entire world, people are observing the Shabbat. And they have a sense of Vayin Nafash, and God rested, which means he was focused more on the soul at that particular time. But whenever you have intimacy, it is a mitzvah, not specifically or only on the Shabbat. Yes. We're getting to that. We're getting to that. That's the next part. You read my mind. Yes, from the end. So therefore, what would you say? Right. Exactly. You know who says that thought? That's not your original thought. As you were saying. There was an article written in the 1960s by Norman Lamb on the Shabbat, and I have it at home someplace, and he says exactly what you said. That what Shabbat is, it's a cessation of public creativity, and it's a focus on private creativity. And very well said, and you and Rabbi Norman. Yes. Excellent. That was excellent. Excellent. Thank you very much. Kedusha means separate, and we see it later on in sentence 31, Vehizartem, from the word nazir, which means to separate. And tameh, there's a sense of separateness. So this is a sense of private kedusha. I didn't think of that. I don't want to go into that right now because it's involved. But on this chapter, it deals with something that's too complicated right now. It deals with something, I'll mention it to you, it's called Tumas Medras Umishkas. But I don't want to go into that, it will take us far afield, okay? But I'm aware of what you say, because we'll deal with that privately, okay? In private Kedusha. So basically what I'm saying, Diana, did you want to say something? Okay. I have time. So basically what the Torah is saying is after you have been involved in private of Kedusha, of intimacy, you should not re-enter the public domain. You should be with yourself and be with your partner and be with God. And therefore, frequently people say, how can I live a religious life? It's frequently because religious life is not lived. And therefore, it doesn't really make sense. But ideally speaking, if religious life could be lived, and you could take time off from whatever things you do publicly and in the community, and focus more on your private development, that is the way sexual intimacy was understood in the Bible. Now let's go to your question. It was a very good question. The next section on sentence 19, and I don't want to go into it too much, deals with a woman who both has a period, and sometimes she's known as a nida, and sometimes she's known as a zava. The word nida is normal menstrual cycle. The word zava means irregular bleeding beyond the time of her cycle. So those are known as nida and zava. And what the Torah says during that time is during that time, a woman, should not be involved in the Mishkan. she should not take a public life of sanctuary at that particular time. And just like a man, which he said before, if he has a nocturnal emission, he should have a sense of privacy unto himself. When a woman menstruates, she should have a sense of privacy and time unto herself. In the book, Women Who Run with the Wolves, which I taught last year, Dr. Estes points out what was done in social anthropology in primitive times. Does anyone remember what she said? So what Phoebe said was that women went to what's known as a hut, where there were other women, and they talked amongst themselves, and they shared intimacy as one woman to another, and she had a respite that time to reconstitute herself. Tamei does not mean unclean, but it was time to reconstitute herself for getting back together within that cycle of life. So looking at things this way, the way I am presenting it, we're looking at three distinct things. Number one, if a man has a nocturnal emission, if husband and wife are intimate, and if a woman has her period or irregular bleeding, in all those three situations, what is needed is time to be with that experience and to reconstitute yourself as much as possible at the moment to actually be. Now that we've understood that, now turn back to the beginning of Tazria, page 460. Without reading all the sentences, let's just do it a little bit. What happens when a woman gives birth? What is the law? No. How many days is she not allowed to be in the mikdash? 40 days if she gave birth to a boy. 80 days if she gave birth to a girl. No, I'll tell you an interesting interpretation, and this interpretation I heard many years ago from Rabbi Norman Lamb. This interpretation, what I'm giving you. So this is not original, okay? He said, when you give birth to a girl has that potential to give birth again. So it's more creativity that you have done by giving birth to a girl, so therefore you need to reconstitute yourself even more. Like there's a parallel in Kabbalah, I don't know if you'll understand as well to say it, between his pashtut, spreading out, and his tsamtzum, which is retracting, tsimtzum. So the more you spread out by having a girl and she has the ability to give birth, the more you need more tsimtzum. That was his interpretation, which I thought was very nice to hear. So therefore, the whole idea of when you give birth, a woman has to either 40 days or 80 days, what's the reason for that? Now that we understand, obviously to take care of the baby. But more than that, to be with the experience of giving birth, which is one of the highest forms of Kedusha. What's the first thing we know about God? The first word? Creativity. Bereshit bara. In the beginning, he created. So you have just created. You have just done imitatio Dei, emulating the ways of God. You have filled the commandment, v'halachta bidrachav, you shall walk in his ways. You are very godly at that moment. You don't have to do anything publicly. You are in that moment of heightened creativity. And that's where you need to be for the next number of weeks. It's not that you are denied something, as many people who do not understand the role of women in Judaism, you're not denied anything. We want you to focus on what is. And what is, you have just given birth. That is the most monumental thing that a woman can experience. That is your Kedusha. Not being penalized, and therefore Tamei
is a separation of Kedusha for the moment, not in a negative way. And that's what most women and most men have not understood. Where? A woman is allowed in Orthodox circumstances, situations, to take a public place. The best example of that is one lady. Does anyone know her name? I'm talking in contemporary life. In Israel? Dr. Leibovitz, Nechama Leibovitz. She's taken a public role. She's one of the best teachers in Bible. She's on Kol Yisrael, and she's written... No, but she takes a public domain. I don't want to get into that detail right now. It's really a detail. It really is a detail. Trust me, it's a detail. If the woman would really focus on what is, the way I have explained it right now, I assure you that detail would not even be in her mind. Yes, I'm... But she needs a partner with this. She needs the complement to be in that situation. And no one in this class, I would venture to say, has ever lived a life as I am saying, so we don't even know how to begin. But if you would live a life and think that the word Tameh is a type of private Kedusha, and think that this is the time of reconstitution of who you are, and after intimacy, you are together with your spouse for the entire 24 hours and immersed into... No one has lived a life like that. This is what was imagined to be. And if we were like that, then I think women would be so satisfied with what they have, they wouldn't look for what they don't have. Going back to the other book, which I teach, of Niels Luhnay, he points out that why is it that the passion is for everything we don't have, but never for what we actually do have? And the same thing goes for your question, which I do respect. But if you would have the passion for what actually is and live it for 10, 20, 30 years, I can assure you, you would be on such a heightened level of Kedusha, these extra things that people are talking about would never even enter your mind. To absorb what is, exactly. Just do it. Yes. Yes, it says both. It does. It does. I didn't understand the third point. I didn't understand it. It's my male mind. I just didn't understand it. Rabbi Mark, what is she saying? No, but you're right. If a person has, Julie is correct, if a person has what's known as obsessive fantasies of compulsive masturbation and things like that, then obviously that person cannot be a high priest. I can't, although my anima is pretty well developed. I didn't hear that, Julie, what? An anima is the feminine side within each masculine experience, and the animus is the masculine side within each female experience. And to the extent that one has developed anima and anima in a balanced equilibrium homeostasis, to such an extent you are a healthy individual. Well, most people nowadays are unable to have freedom to experience the moment. Most people, based on, for example, there's something called Beck's Scale of Depression, which says that depression is based on thoughts about your past, anticipatory reflection about the future, and no one really lives in the moment. If you're able to live in the moment and really, let's say, breathe, and breathing is a form which is called nishama, where you actually breathe in the moment. To be in the moment is a form which is called nishama, where you actually breathe in the moment. To be in the moment, then you're really in that activity. And therefore, one of the things the Torah is saying is maybe what you need to do is not only what people say meditate, but actually breathe. And I have helped, and Rabbi Marcus helped certain people that are, and Carol has helped. There are people on beds in orthopedic, and they can't move. Carol has taught them how to breathe. People on dialysis, we teach them how to breathe. So during that time, they're actually doing something of significance, and they go deeper and deeper within themselves. And this is almost a lost art. Rabbi Mark, do you want to take the next question? Hey, why are you so quiet today? Who wants to talk? Yes, Lillian. And then Diana. Yeah. Well, that's what I'm talking about. That's exactly what I'm saying. Right, that's exactly what I'm saying. Yes, Diana? Holiness. Right. And therefore, maybe it's more than one would anticipate. Is that what you're saying? It takes. So therefore, one would need to be together, so to be, absolutely, Stephen. No, I really didn't say that. And a man as well. Man as well. We don't know what we're talking about here because people have not lived accordingly. I want to go to one more. Yes. I hear what you say.
I think what needs to be done first, at least for a year, to live this way and then come back. Let me give a man a chance to ask. Ultimately, what the private aspect of Kedusha means is that there are